Welcome to Season 3 of the Change Management Podcast by the University of South Wales. My name is Jonathan Deacon, Professor of Marketing in the School of Design, Digital and Marketing, and I'm joined by my colleague Phil Harfield from the Faculty of Creative Industries. And Phil is an expert in design thinking. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Jonathan. Really looking forward to today's conversation.
I think we're going to have a good one today. In this season, we're exploring the concept of design thinking, how it can apply to business, and how it works in practice. We discuss how design thinking can help any organization become an agile one. In this episode, we introduce the concept of user-centered design and how it leads to innovation and improved problem solving by focusing on your customers' needs. To help us today, we have a special guest, Damien Sangster, who is a delivery coach. Hello, Damien.
Hi there, Jonathan.
Okay, gentlemen, let's get cracking. And I suppose it's an obvious one. Phil, what is user-centered design?
Yes, I suppose it is an obvious one, but the answer isn't quite so obvious. So user-centered design is really a core principle for design thinking or design thinking activities. So the idea of asking your users, asking people for their insights into the problems they have, the needs they have, and really asking them to define those problems. So it's kind of a precursor to all design-related activity that's based on understanding what those needs are, answering those needs. So I guess from a product design perspective, it's things like the interface of the product. Is it usable in terms of its functionality? Is it usable in terms of the feedback you get from using a product? So it has multiple roles. So I guess back in the good old market intelligence days, getting users as customers, getting feedback on their perceptions of your company, their perceptions of your services or your products is one aspect of it. But really, it's, I guess, a trigger for idea generation, using real-world problems, real-world experts, users as the owners of those problems to try and understand how our ideas should respond to those problems. So it's really about feedback.
Okay, so is this about putting the shoes of the end user on and seeing the world from their perspective?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the words we'll probably use a lot is perspectives. So the idea of just looking at it from your own perspective and all the kind of the assumptions and biases that you may have as an individual or as an organization, you know, is a lot of the real risks of doing things in isolation, doing things without a collaborative mindset. And really that goes to the nature of the problems that are changing around us, really. So problems are much more open-ended, problems are much more social, much more reliant on understanding other people's perspectives and really the behaviours that people have that are implied in some of this.
Okay, we'll come on to that, I'm sure, in a short while. Damien, from your perspective, you practice user-centred design approaches. What does it mean to you from a business perspective?
Ultimately, it's about eliminating those risks that were just mentioned. So the earlier you can involve actual users, actual end customers in the process of both designing and building something, you remove the need for rework, which can be costly down the line, right? If we were to make an assumption on we need to build a thing to solve a problem, we go and design that thing, build that thing, it takes us 6 months. And at the end of that 6 months, we hand it over to the users and then we find out that it doesn't solve the problem, then that's obviously costly, right? So user-centric design goes hand in hand with agility, right? What we're trying to do is test and learn hypotheses as early as possible in the process with real users, with you know, different perspectives, different ages of users, people that may not be as digitally native as other users may be. You know, we look at it from a wide range of perspectives and really you suck all that information up and iterate and learn from what we discover.
Want to empower your teams to think differently and solve complex problems? Start your design thinking journey today. Search USW Design Thinking.
And hypotheses in this instance, as a research academic, I use hypotheses quite a lot. Is it the same in user-centered design, as in that we may have a feeling about something? We've got a bit of a hunch and we just want to test that out. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's critical to being good at user-centric design, right? It's the ability as a team or an organization to understand that experimentation is required. And often with experimentation comes, I hate to use this word, but either failure or mistakes. And again, part of, for me, part of being agile is accepting and embracing failure and mistakes when it comes to hypotheses, because that's the only way we can learn and actually build or solve the problem which, you know, is at hand.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes, absolutely. It may be a hunch. You may have some data which you know you've built hypotheses around. But until you actually experiment with those things in the wild with actual users and people, you never know, you know, what the outcome of that hypothesis will be.
Yeah, yeah. In some of my own consulting practice, you know, we talk about that concept of failing fast, don't yeah. we? You know, if you're not failing, you're not growing, you're not moving forward. And it's not the failing that's the issue. It's recognizing, isn't it, that you've given something a go, but if it fails, move on quickly, learn from that situation.
Absolutely.
Phil, give us perhaps an example then of, you know, perhaps a well-known, a well-identified user-centered design, either a product or a service. What have you got in there to explain that to us?
Well, I suppose there's a good danger, and anyone Googling user-centered design or design thinking will come across, you know, your Amazons, your Netflix, and your Ubers, and your digitally enabled new companies. So I think I don't really want to create that as a kind of a platform of expectation, especially for like SMEs or small companies or micro companies looking into this conversation. So I think the kind of examples, you know, we have on our doorstep of social innovators, companies looking at digital technologies to perhaps in patient care domains, bearing in mind all it is, in its simple terms, it's asking your customer, asking your end user, asking someone who's a beneficiary from your service, from your products, from your businesses, is the experience of doing that, of participating in our business, what you expect? So okay. Really, it doesn't really matter who you are, what size you are as an organization.
And I think if we're probably really honest about this, I think if we looked at the products and services that surround us today, I think we could probably quite easily identify those that have got a user-centered design about them, because they're nice to use. They're nice companies to do business with and so on.
Yeah.
So I suspect that's how we might look at that. How do organizations use this concept then for the purpose of innovation and problem solving? Damien, how do you go about that?
If you put the user or a customer at the heart of your process, if you obsess over, you know, your customer or user, it's very hard not to be innovative, right? So to name check the company, you know, Amazon's very customer-centric, customer-focused, because I think Jeff Bezos famously once said, like, the customer's never going to want, you know, slower delivery time, right? They're never going to want, you know, less choice. So if you obsess over the customer's needs, the customer's always going to have, you know, more wants, more needs, more desires. They want the experience to have less friction or be frictionless. So if you put the user and the customer at the center of how you work, it's actually quite hard not to be innovative, right? If you put your technology at the center of how you want to work, then you can stagnate around a certain technology. Or if you put, you know, your objectives, your company objectives around the center of how you want to work, obviously those are very important, but you can kind of get closed off by your own biases and your own viewpoints. The customer's at the heart of everything you do, then you innovate, you know, by proxy, because the customer always wants innovation, right? They always want new things. They want to see improvement.
We are an inquisitive species, aren't we? We want those things.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a process where you put the customer first, you remain, you know, inquisitive, curious, empathetic, and you ultimately listen to what they're saying, then what you often find is that your roadmap, the next iteration of whatever you're building, will by nature be innovative, because you're listening to all those things that they want.
And also, I think it's worthwhile at this point to recognize that many organizations, particularly smaller organizations, have been set up and started by people that probably faced a problem anyway and set about trying to solve it for themselves. And in doing so, found that other people were intrigued by that solving of the problem. So, you know, being close to the customer sometimes is a lot easier than we actually give it credit for, because you might actually be, as an owner, manager, entrepreneur, part of that tribe of customers who are looking for that problem to be solved. And I think we sometimes overlook that. You went through a very interesting list there, Damien, of bits and pieces that we should be thinking about when we're looking at how to innovate and problem solve. But I guess, and maybe Phil, you want to take this one first, that there could be a problem in long list of problems. Which ones do I tackle first? What are the right problems to solve?
Well, I think that's kind of the age-old designer's dilemma, really, of I guess you're given, as a designer, you're given a brief and to respond to, it's around a given problem from a client, and the expectation is you provide a solution and get a fee granted to you if you find an appropriate solution to that problem. So I think the moment you step into this, actually, how do I challenge that as a designer in that role? So having users or end users to frame or challenge the brief to a certain extent is what I kind of encourage through some of my practice at USW. So we are not the experts as designers, although we like to propose to be, and it might be unnatural for most designers to propose that. But I think if the moment we say step outside our expertise and say, well, the users as an expert perspective on this, we understand perhaps some of the context of the problem, but we don't necessarily have that as a central part of our lives. You know, obviously on a kind of extremes, people with disabilities as product designers, you know, I mean, my background's in product design. So the idea of ergonomics and human factors are longstanding things in designing, you know, a vegetable peeler with a soft grip for people with arthritis, you know, in their hands or impaired dexterity. So I think that kind of design thinking that allows you to say, well, actually, I'm not going to jump into a solution mindset. The thing that I like and the thing that is sexy and attractive to me as a designer is the solution. I'm going to spend half of my time thinking about the problem. Who owns that problem? Is it the right problem to solve? Am I looking at it from perspectives outside my own? And obviously asking that person with arthritis or an impairment to be part of that solution will drive you to a right conclusion in an ideal scenario.
So, Damien, in your practice, you're facing a client and they have that long list of problems that they perhaps see. What's your nuts and bolts approach then to choosing the right problems? Is it the easy wins, or is it actually, you know, paradoxically, the more complex will give the better solution?
So you've got to look at the data. And a lot of the times, part of the challenge is not having enough data around a problem, right? But if you have data, then you can make a decision, right? So number of users it impacts per se, or what kind of cost is associated to not solving the problem, would usually drive kind of the approach to what comes first. Like, how do we prioritize, you know, that list of big problems? But again, you know, like it's about having data, or if you don't have data, doing enough research around the problem to make an assumption on what that data is. So that's how, you know, from a nuts and bolts point of view, I'd look at any problem or any, you know, list of issues on a backlog, you know, in an agile fashion, and say, right, what's the most important thing here? Obviously, then, you know, you might have some dependencies or some things which you can't tackle immediately. So maybe even though they're still high priority, they may have critical dependencies which can't be met yet. And then you might look for some lower hanging fruit. But essentially, you know, look at the problem, look at the data around it, look at the facts of what fixing problem A will solve and grant the business, or and grant the user, grant the customer, versus what problem B will solve, and weigh the two things up in a apples to apples case if you can.
So can I push you a little bit on just this whole idea of data? Because I get quite cross when people start talking about data, because there's a whole narrative out there, isn't there, which I'm sure is very confusing to anybody trying to run a small business.
Yeah, sure.
This whole concept of big data. Now, in your world, talk to me about the data that you kind of access, where you can access it maybe. You know, is it always big data?
So let's remove the word big, because the word big is scary when we talk about data. So let's take a typical example, right? So we have a hypothesis. We include our users and do, you know, a user-centric design process, test our hypothesis. Let's say we're building a web page. Build a web page. And we build the web page so that it has analytic software, you know, back-ended into that web page. What you'd start to see over time is the friction points in that data. So customers are getting three pages into the journey, and then they're dropping out the journey. They're closing the browser down, right? So we can look at that data and we can say, what is it which is stopping the customers from, you know, progressing to the shopping cart at the end of the journey, or whatever it may be, right? Whatever the outcome we're looking for them to achieve. So, you know, if you're seeing that 80% of your users are dropping out on one page, then we can take a look at that page and we could start to hypothesize around, you know, what the problem could potentially be there. Is that a design problem? And then we can do another iteration of what is the problem here. Maybe we can do some more prototyping around different ways of how we can solve that, again, with real users and get that actual feedback. Yeah, it doesn't have to be the scary big data, but if you're building software, then definitely ensure that you are getting data points back from whatever you build. Often it's kind of like a nice to have at the end of a roadmap for lots of teams, but it's often the most important thing because it can literally lead us to what we need to do next, right? And it can give us that user feedback without having to use real people in a room when we do user testing, say. So yeah, that's what I mean by data. But you know, it might not be a website you're building. Let's not just look at this from a digital point of view. Maybe you've got a bricks and mortar store, right? And you have adverts on the front of the windows trying to entice people in. Well, maybe you know those adverts aren't working so well, and you're not getting as many customers through the door as you'd like. And you have two stores, so maybe you can do some testing with one store. You use different coloured advertisement versus another in any other. Do you know what I mean? Like data could be footfall through the shops, for instance. So just look at what your users are doing.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting and very, very useful, because it says that, you know, data, we talk about data, but actually what is it? It's about information, it's about insight, it's about knowledge, isn't it? About what's going on, as you say, you know, kind of getting to know what customers, you know, how they're reacting to things. That's data. You know, this whole narrative around the big data, sorry, I use the big word again, but you know, that's I think slightly off-putting. There can be some really big wins in some really small data.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, just observing and looking at things. Phil, we sometimes, when we're talking about user-centric design, we talk about a concept of design-related bias. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I think whenever you're talking to a human being or a user, the idea of biases or, you know, assumptions that are made are core. So we're essentially being challenged and channeled through our world, our digital world, our world through, you know, our biases. So our cognitive biases, how we think, how we react, how we behave in response to certain information we're getting is really interesting. So the idea of being in control of our behaviors, you know, if I'm an advertising agency and knowing cognitive biases, knowing how our audience respond to perhaps behavioral nudges, you know, why does every time I go in to get a coffee and a loyalty card already has one of those six things already printed off for me? That's a nudge to say, well, you know, you've got an artificial head start here. And my behavior, my tendency to want to finish something that's already been started is being nudged in that direction. So I think there's evidence throughout every aspect of our daily lives of how we're being nudged and how our biases are being, I guess, used perhaps in to manipulate us into certain behaviors if you have a kind of a cynical mindset to it. But really is how as designers you can use it to your benefit. So as long as you're doing it for the greater good to solve problems that a user has, I think is to our advantage, really.
About a million years ago, when I was a much younger man, I was asked to go into an organization to have a look at their marketing strategy and their strategy overall. And it was a quite well-established second generation family business. And I will paraphrase, because what their approach to a lot of this was that, you know, it was kind of, this is the way that we've always done things. This is the way that we will always do things around here. And there was a bias in that, because their approach to development of new product, new service was biased by history. So how should we challenge that? How should we, you know, Damien, how do you get organizations to challenge their bias about where they've come from?
So again, it's data. Show them facts rather than, you know, hunches. And again, it's around listening to users, putting the users centrally in the process. I'll give a working example. I worked with a client a few years ago, and C-level of this company, we were building an application, and they were demanding that the next thing we build was X feature, right? And it's because they had a very biased view on these are high-powered people, and they needed that feature because of their lifestyles. But when we looked at all of the feedback from actual users in the App Store, which is, you know, one way you can actually get real feedback from people, you know, when you download an app, by the way, always review, always put your comments, right? Because developers will be looking at those things, and they'll be looking at those things to
you know, don't you? You know that I don't do that. That's exactly what I don't do.
Well, you know, you may get the feature you want next if you ask. But we literally looked at App Store feedback, and real people who use the app day on day didn't want X feature, they wanted Y feature because that would change their lives, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So it gave us a powerful kind of message back to the C-suite of the organization to say, well, three people here might want this feature, but 5,000 of your actual users, your actual customers want this thing. And I think we did end up delivering feature X, but it was 2 years down the line because there was, you know, way more important things to the actual users. So again, use data, use real life feedback, and try and build those mechanisms into your process. If you have no voice from the customer, then try and work out a way you can get it and use those messages with whoever you need to influence. But also be open to other opinions. Like we need to challenge our own mindset as much as possible.
Yeah, I just think that I really, really agree. And the idea of you not having a critical eye, so asking users without a critical eye of the response you're getting is and questioning their motivations. It's kind of a really cliched quote, but you know, Henry Ford, if I ask my customers what they want, they'll ask for a faster horse. So I think, you know, although it's a cliche, I think it's really true that, you know, unless we're inviting confirmation bias otherwise, we're inviting the fact that, you know, the CEO who has the loudest, shoutiest voice is going to get everything done in to their perspective. So getting the users in, getting people that are going to contradict, hopefully, and undermine and point fingers and break our assumptions in a way that supports us objectively is really what we're trying to encourage.
And listen, in a post-carbon world, we might all want faster horses, actually, you know. Okay, a couple of things in there, which I think I just need to almost stop and pause and explain something about. Damien, you spoke about C-suite. For listeners who are unaware of what C-suite is, it's that group of senior executives in an organization, chief marketing officer, chief information officer, CEO, chief executive officer. So it's that kind of level of decision-making within an organization, which we might find in larger organizations. And I must admit, when I've done work at board level before now, I often talk to people about having an explorative mindset, you know, having that ability to take opinion from all kind of directions, even if it may be uncomfortable. You know, that's the challenge. If I feel uncomfortable by it, maybe I ought to take a closer look at it because it might just be quite important to me, because that might be where the next kind of generation of audience, generation of market comes from. So we've been dancing around the idea of digital organizations. Damien, how would you identify, what are the signs of a digitally progressive organization?
From a design and a user-centered design point of view, it'd be what we've discussed, right? The organization listens to their users, has multiple ways of listening to their users, built into that process. We'll progressively look at what the users are asking for next, and we'll include users in designing iterations of whatever it is they're building next. And we'll have that mindset you just mentioned, which is, you know, willing to be challenged, that mentality that failure is okay, because with failure comes learning, and we can learn to do the right thing next time around, or it can lead the product down the correct path. It being a safe environment to experiment, to test hypotheses, and be challenged. So from a design point of view, it should be a real open environment where we're challenging ourselves consistently, we're challenging our viewpoints consistently, and learning from users as frequently as possible.
Okay, so it's perhaps about being brave, actually.
Yeah, and there's a really great term for this called psychological safety. The best organizations are psychologically safe organizations where you can have those brave conversations, you can have those challenging conversations, you can have different opinions, different points of view coming into your organization, and it doesn't scare you. It doesn't lead to finger pointing. It leads to a celebration of the fact that you can do that.
Comes to that point in the podcast where I have to ask you and put you both on the spot and say, okay, what advice would you give to our listeners and anyone in an organization who is planning to adopt any of the methods that we've discussed today? Phil, let's start with you.
Well, I suppose there's kind of three don'ts I'd phrase. So don't think that user-centered design or design thinking or asking your users is another set of tasks to manage as a project. Don't think it's another thing, an activity that's an additional activity. So I think going back to the kind of the last question, the idea of your maturity as an organization, you know, going from its products and services tweaking to its thinking about process to a higher level, it's thinking about strategy, how your users become implicit in all your strategic decision making is really, so the other don't is, so don't look for tangible data and evidence just purely to base your decision making on. The idea of insights, the idea of you'll get complex answers from your users, you'll get misinformed answers, you'll get uncertainty and confusion. So don't necessarily call it data as we understand data. And I guess, again, don't get caught up in the rhetoric, perhaps, of the Amazons and the Netflix, and that start small. Don't wait for things to be perfect or be a perfect fit. It's probably something you're doing already on a small scale. You know, what business doesn't ask its users for some input? See if you can do it on a formal setting and look at user-centered design thing as a way to do that.
And Damien, last word to you. What advice would you give?
Just to reiterate, start. Do it. So and try and start as small as possible. So think of ways that you can have that relationship with your customers. And absolutely correct. It doesn't need to be a multi-million pound solution which encompasses all things, but start small, identify that voice, and start living by the mantra of, you know, your user, your customer is the most important thing to the process of building and designing.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both for a very interesting discussion. We've been chatting about user-centered design, which I think we should acknowledge, you know, that we've spoken about it, we've thought about it, but actually it's about the actions, it's the doings as well. If you want to hear more of the Change Management podcast, please don't forget to follow us in the normal way. Thanks for listening, and thank you to our guest, Damien Sangster. To find out more about this podcast and our business services at USW, please visit southwales.ac.uk/business.